Chapter 35. Murmured through her midnight dreams, but she would have been happier if they had shed some definite light on the future. That would come, no doubt, when he had had time to look about and get his bearings. She counted up the days that must elapse before she received his next letter and stole down early to peep at the papers and learn when the next American mail was due. At length the happy date arrived, and she hurried distractedly through the day's work, trying to conceal her impatience by the endearments she bestowed upon her pupils. It was easier, in her present mood, to kiss them than to keep them at their grammars. That evening, on me, Clopin's threshold, her heart beat so wildly that as he had to lean a moment against the doorpost before entering. But on the hall table, where the letters lay, there was none for her. She went over them with a feverish hand, her heart dropping down and down, as he had sometimes fallen down an endless stairway in a dream, the very same stairway up which as he had seemed to fly when she climbed the long hill to Deering's door. Then it suddenly struck her that Andorra might have found and secreted her letter, and with a spring she was on the actual stairs and rattling Miss Macy's door handle. "You've a letter for me, haven't you?" she panted. Miss Macy, turning from the toilet table, enclosed her in attenuated arms. Oh, darling, did you expect one today? Do give it to me," Lizzie pleaded with burning eyes. "But I haven't any. There hasn't been a sign of a letter for you." "I know there is. There must be," Lizzie persisted, stamping her foot. "But, dearest, I've watched for you, and there has been nothing, absolutely nothing." Day after day, for the ensuing weeks, the same scene reenacted itself with endless variations. Lizzie, after the first sharp spasm of disappointment, made no effort to conceal her anxiety from Miss Macy, and the fond Andorra was charged to keep a vigilant eye upon the postman's coming, and to spy on the bond for possible negligence or perfidy. But these elaborate precautions remained fruitless, and no letter from Deering came. During the first fortnight of silence, Lizzie exhausted all the ingenuities of explanation. She marveled afterward at the reasons as he had found for Deering's silence. There were moments when she almost argued herself into thinking it more natural than his continuing to write. There was only one reason which her intelligence consistently rejected, and that was the possibility that he had forgotten her, that the whole episode had faded from his mind like a breath from a mirror. From that she resolutely turned her thoughts, aware that if she suffered herself to contemplate it, the motive power of life would fail, and she would no longer understand why she rose up in the morning and lay down at night. If as he had had leisure to indulge her anguish, she might have been unable to keep such speculations at bay. But as he had to be up and working, the Blanchisseuse had to be paid, and me, Clopin's weekly bill, and all the little straws that even her frugal habits had to reckon with. And in the depths of her thought dwelt the dogging fear of illness and incapacity, goading her to work while she could. She hardly remembered the time when as he had been without that fear. It was second nature now, and it kept her on her feet when other incentives might have failed. In the blankness of her misery she felt no dread of death, but the horror of being ill and dependent was in her blood. In the first weeks of silence she wrote again and again to Deering, entreating him for a word, for a mere sign of life. From the first as he had shrunk from seeming to assert any claim on his future, yet in her aching bewilderment she now charged herself with having been too possessive, too exacting in her tone. She told herself that his fastidiousness shrank from any but a eye touch, and that hers had not been light enough. She should have kept to the character of the idle friend, the artless consciousness in which tormented genius may find an escape from its complexities. And instead, she had dramatized their relation, exaggerated her own part in it, presumed, forsooth, to share the front of the stage with him, instead of being content to serve as scenery or chorus. But though to herself she admitted, and even insisted on, the episodical nature of the experience, On the fact that for the ring it could be no more than an incident, she was still convinced that his sentiment for her, however fugitive, had been genuine. His had not been the attitude of the unscrupulous male seeking a vulgar advantage. For a moment he had really needed her, and if he was silent now, it was perhaps because he feared that as he had mistaken the nature of the need, and built vain hopes on its possible duration. It was of the very essence of Lizzie's devotion that it sought instinctively the larger freedom of its object. She could not conceive of love under any form of exaction or compulsion. To make this clear to Deering became an overwhelming need, and in a last short letter she explicitly freed him from whatever sentimental obligation its predecessors might have seemed to impose. In this chittied communication she playfully accused herself of having unwittingly sentimentalized their relation, affirming, in self-defense, a retrospective astuteness, a sense of the impermanence of the tenderer sentiments, that almost put Deering in the fatuous position of having mistaken coquetry for surrender. And she ended gracefully with a plea for the continuance of the friendly regard which as he had always understood to be the basis of their sympathy. The document, when completed, seemed to her worthy of what she conceived to be Deering's conception of a woman of the world, and she found a spectral satisfaction in the thought of making her final appearance before him in that distinguished character. But she was never destined to learn what effect the appearance produced, for the letter, like those it sought to excuse, remained unanswered. The fresh spring sunshine which had so often attended Lizzie Weston her moldy climb up the hill of St. Cloud beamed on her, some 2 years later, in a scene and a situation of altered import. The horse chestnuts of the Champs-Élysées filtered its rays through the symmetrical umbrage enclosing the graveled space about Dorrance Restaurant, and Miss West, seated at a table within that privileged circle, presented to the light a hat much better able to sustain its scrutiny than those which had sheltered the brow of Juliet Deering's instructress. Her dress was in keeping with the hat, and both belonged to a situation rich in such possibilities as the act of a leisurely luncheon at Dorrance in the opening week of the salon. Her companions, of both sexes, confirmed and emphasized this impression by an elaborateness of garb, and an ease of attitude implying the largest range of selection between the forms of Parisian idleness. And even Andora Macy, seated opposite, as in the place of co-hostess or companion, reflected, in coy grays and mauves, the festal note of the occasion. This note reverberated persistently in the ears of a solitary gentleman straining for glimpses of the group from a table wedged in the remotest corner of the garden. But to Miss West herself the occurrence did not rise above the usual. For nearly a year as he had been acquiring the habit of such situations, and the act of offering a luncheon at Dorrance to her cousins, the Harvey Mearses of Providence, and their friend Mr. Jackson Benn, produced in her no emotion beyond the languid glow which Mr. Ben's presence was beginning to impart to such scenes. "It's frightful, the way you've got used to it," Andora McGee had wailed in the first days of her friend's transfigured fortune, when Lizzie West had waked one morning, to find herself among the heirs of an old and miserly cousin whose testamentary dispositions had formed, since her earliest childhood, the subject of pleasantry and conjecture in her own improvident family. Old Ezra Mears had never given any sign of life to the luckless Wests, had perhaps hardly been conscious of including them in the carefully drawn will which, following the old American convention, scrupulously divided his hoarded millions among his kin. It was by a mere genealogical accident that Lizzie, falling just within the golden circle, found herself possessed of a pittance sufficient to release her from the prospect of a long gray future in me. Clopin's pension. The release had seemed wonderful at first, yet she presently found that it had destroyed her former world without giving her a new one. On the ruins of the old pension life bloomed the only flower that had ever sweetened her path. and beyond the sense of present ease, and the removal of anxiety for the future, her reconstructed existence blossomed with no compensating joys. She had hoped great things from the opportunity to rest, to travel, to look about her, above all, in various artful feminine ways, to be ice to the companions of her less privileged state. But such widenings of scope left her, as it were, but the more conscious of the empty margin of personal life beyond them. It was not till she woke to the leisure of her new days, that she had the full sense of what was gone from them. Their very emptiness made her strain to pack them with transient sensations. She was like the possessor of an unfurnished house, with random furniture and bric-a-brac perpetually pouring in an approval. It was in this experimental character that Mr. Jackson Bennett fixed her attention, and the languid effort of her imagination to adjust him to her requirements was seconded by the fervent complicity of Andorra and the smiling approval of her cousins. Lizzie did not discourage these demonstrations. She suffered serenely Andorra's allusions to Mr. Ben's infatuation and Mrs. Muir's casual boast of his business standing. All the better if he could drape his narrow square-shouldered frame and round unwinking countenance in the trailing mists of sentiment. Lizzie looked and listened, not unhopeful of the miracle. "I never saw anything like the way these Frenchmen stare. Doesn't it make you nervous, Lizzie?" Mrs. Mears broke out suddenly, ruffling her feather boa about an outraged bosom. Mrs. Mears was still in that stage of development when her countrywomen taste to the full the peril of being exposed to the gaze of the licentious Gaul. Lizzie roused herself from the contemplation of Mr. Ben's round baby cheeks and the square blue jaw resting on his perpendicular collar. "Is someone staring at me?" she asked with a smile. "Don't turn round, whatever you do. They're just over there, between the rhododendrons, the tall fair man alone at that table. Really, Harvey, I think you ought to speak to the head waiter, or something. Though I suppose in one of these places they'd only laugh at you," Mrs. Mears shudderingly concluded. Her husband, as if inclining to this probability, continued the undisturbed dissection of his chicken wing, but Mr. Ben, perhaps aware that his situation demanded a more punctilious attitude, sternly revolved upon the parapet of his high collar in the direction of Mrs. Mears' glance. "What, that fellow all alone over there? Why, he's not French, he's an American," he then proclaimed with a perceptible relaxing of the facial muscles. "Oh," murmured Mrs. Mears, as perceptibly disappointed, and Mr. Ben continued carelessly, "He came over on the steamer with me. He's some kind of an artist, a fellow named Deering. He was staring at me, I guess. Wondering whether I was going to remember him. Why, how d'ye do? How are you? Why, yes, of course. With pleasure, my friends, Mrs. Harvey Mears, Mr. Mears. My friends Miss Macy and Miss West." "I have the pleasure of knowing Miss West," said Vincent Deering with a smile. "Why?" Even through his smile Lizzie had seen, in the first moment, how changed he was, and the impression of the change deepened to the point of pain when, a few days later, in reply to his brief note, she accorded him a private hour. That the first sight of his writing the first answer to his letters should have come, after 3 long years, in the shape of this impersonal line, too curt to be called humble, yet confessing to a consciousness of the past by the studied avoidance of its language. As she read, her mind flashed back over what she had dreamed his letters would be, over the exquisite answers as he had composed above his name. There was nothing exquisite in the conventional lines before her, but dormant nerves began to throb again at the mere touch of the paper he had touched, and she threw the little note into the fire before she dared to reply to it. Now that he was actually before her again, he became, as usual, the one live spot in her consciousness. Once more her tormented throbbing self sank back passive and numb, but now with all its power of suffering mysteriously transferred to the presence, so known, yet so unknown, at the opposite corner of her earth. She was still Lizzie West, and he was still Vincent Deering, but the sticks rolled between them, and she saw his face through its fog. It was his face, really, rather than his words, that told her, as she furtively studied it, the tale of failure and slow discouragement which had so blurred its handsome lines. She kept afterward no precise memory of the actual details of his narrative. The pain it evidently caused him to impart it was so much the sharpest fact in her new vision of him. Confusedly, however, she gathered that on reaching America he had found his wife's small property gravely impaired, and that, while lingering on to secure what remained of it, he had contrived to sell a picture or two, and had even known a brief moment of success, during which he received orders and set up a studio. But inexplicably the tide had ebbed, his work remained on his hands, and a tedious illness, with its miserable sequel of debt, soon wiped out his small advantage. There followed a period of eclipse, still more vaguely pictured, during which she was allowed to infer that he had tried his hand at divers means of livelihood, accepting employment from a fashionable house decorator, designing wallpapers, illustrating magazine articles, and acting for a time, she dimly understood, as the social tout of a new hotel desirous of advertising its restaurant. These disjointed facts were strung on the slender thread of personal allusions, references to friends who had been kind, jealously, she guessed them to be women, and to enemies who had darkly schemed against him. But, true to his tradition of correctness, he carefully avoided the mention of names, and left her trembling conjectures to grope dimly through an alien crowded world in which there seemed little room for her small shy presence. As she listened, her private pang was merged in the intolerable sense of his unhappiness. Nothing he had said explained, or excused his conduct to her, but he had suffered, he had been lonely, had been humiliated, and she suddenly felt, with a fierce maternal rage. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.